Hello, and welcome to the latest Engineers Against Poverty in Conversation with podcast. I am John Hawkins, EAP Programme Director, and in this series, we hear from a wide range of voices from around the world to discuss some of the critical issues in the world of infrastructure, engineering, and development. For the first time, I'm joined by two guests. Firstly, Pamela Acheng, a lecturer in the Department for Construction Management and Economics at the University of Makerere, and the team leader for the COST Uganda Assurance Team. And I'm also joined by Diana Rosa, who is the Monitoring Evaluation Coordinator for COST Honduras and has the important role of capturing all the success that that program has had. It is now 4 months since the world came to Scotland for COP26. What really struck me was that the countries such as Fiji are already having to take the extreme measure of moving communities to areas where they are less likely to be at risk from extreme weather and rising sea levels. A few weeks earlier, a colleague shared the UN Independent Expert Report on Climate Finance that was published in late 2020. Entitled Delivering on the $100 billion Climate Finance Commitment and Transforming Climate Finance, I was struck by how many times the report referred to the importance of data and transparency in terms of clearly tracking and counting what is considered climate finance. We at EAP, as hosts of the Infrastructure Transparency Initiative, better known as COST, have been considering how infrastructure data can be connected to climate data. And then I was really keen to talk to Pamela and Diana about the impact of climate change in their respective countries and how COST Uganda and COST Honduras have been responding to this challenge and how the financing and delivery of low carbon resilient infrastructure can be more transparent and accountable. Welcome to you, Pamela and Diana. Thank you for joining me today. Diana, can I start with you? In late 2020, Honduras was hit by two devastating hurricanes in Eta and Iota. Within days of each other, dozens of people were killed. It'd be great if you could tell our listeners about the impact of the two devastating hurricanes, in Honduras and on the communities.
Thank you, John. Hi, everybody, and thank you, John, for having us. It's a pleasure. Yes, Honduras is a country that is very vulnerable to different natural threats. With tropical storm Eta and Iota, it is estimated that the total cost of that effects has been approximately 52,099 million lems, our local currency. The damage represents 44% of this amount, losses were 52%, and additional costs were 44%. The impact on economic activity, it is estimated at 0.8 percentage point of our GDP in 2020 and 0.3 percentage points of GDP in 2021. It is also estimated that the primary affected population is approximately 437,000 people, 55% of whom live in the Department of Cortez that is located in our north coast. As a result, 95 people lost their lives. We have people that were reported missing, and we have over 437,000 people that were evacuated. Approximately 88% of them were located in five departments or regions of our countries. We also have people that were sheltered. There were more than 96,000 people registered in the 1,000 formal shelters that were installed in 78 local governments of our total 298 in the country. The most affected was Cortez. COPECO, which is the institution that was in charge, that is in charge of giving response to this type of emergency, reported on November 25 that 3,907,229 people were affected by Eta and Iota directly and indirectly. In total, we also have 388 health buildings that were affected. The education infrastructure of the country was affected, causing damage to 534 educational establishments that represented 3% in total. In addition, 620 educational establishments has to be used as a temporary shelter. It also affects in some way at least the 5% of the country's 1.8 million occupied homes. And it is estimated that the damage to health and infrastructure affected 92,246 households and has a total cost of approximately 5.5 million. On the other hand, infrastructure has a total cost of approximately 5.420 million slams in sectors such as agricultural, tourism, transportation, communication were also affected.
Thank you, Sue. I mean, it's amazing how, you know, the long-term impact economically was really interesting there, as well as obviously the impact on people, on housing, on home, on schools and health facilities. I mean, how has the government responded to this devastating impact?
Well, Hurricane Eta, at first it was a hurricane, was formed on October 31. So on November 2, there was a state emergency was declared, firstly on 10 departments of the country. But on November 6, this decree was modified and the state of emergency was declared throughout the national territory due to the effects that were caused by this tropical storm in that moment. This state of emergency was valid until December 31, 2020, and the government stated that it may be extended if the effects gave rise to the emergency persist. So Hurricane Eta, or tropical storm, dissipated on November 3rd. For its part, we have the Hurricane Iota that was formed on that Friday, November 13. They were very simultaneously. So on November 18, an executive decree and number 109/2020 and some articles of the decree 113 were modified to extend the action described to include other climatic phenomena, meaning the Iota, that caused damage to the productive infrastructure of the country on a national level. So the government immediately instructed the entities that were related to infrastructure works, road infrastructure, critical infrastructure of the country, and flood control to immediately address the rehabilitation of road sections and flood control infrastructures that were damaged by the rain, wind, and landslide, as well as carrying out evaluation, design, cleaning, repair, and reconstruction of infrastructure work, supervision, monitoring, and contracting to carry out cleaning activities and recovery of access roads and housing in different neighborhoods, colonies, and villages that were affected nationwide by this tropical storm Eta Iota. As a result, 87 institutions, public institutions, 7 from the central government and 80 from local government, had budget assigned to address this emergency. And an estimate of 754 infrastructure projects were done as a response of the emergency during and after the incident. And lastly, a law was approved by the Congress. It's called the Law of the Facilitation of International Humanitarian Assistance in Case of Disaster and Initial Recovery. It was approved in 2020 by our National Congress.
Great, that's very interesting. And I think that particularly how they kind of tried to define the climate, the events, the weather events in that framework, and it's obviously very, very broad. So Pamela, how are you seeing climate change impacting Uganda? You know, what type of extreme weather are you seeing on a day-to-day basis?
Thank you, John. Thank you so much for having us join this conversation. It's really much appreciated. So back to your question, and I need to first paint a picture. So Uganda lies within a relatively humid equatorial climate zone, and we have generally typically two seasons. That's a wet and a dry season. And we have two wet and two dry seasons throughout the year. And these seasons have been relatively consistent in the past. However, in the recent past, we're beginning to observe changes in those weather patterns. We're seeing increased frequencies of extreme weather events like floods and droughts. About 2 years ago, we had a really bad flood that took an entire town and basically destroyed a lot of infrastructure, schools, roads, and even communities. We're also seeing changes in the water levels at Lake Victoria. There are also increases in temperature, which are increasing the vulnerabilities and further lowering the capacities of the communities to adapt. And these will have impacted our infrastructure. So as I mentioned, we've seen a lot of transport infrastructure cut off due to either flooding or landslides. and many of these are also being affected by increased precipitation, where more in the design related aspects, more technically, we're seeing further or accelerated aging of the binder on our flexible pavements. We've also seen a couple of bridges in our districts washed away. And these are really pointing out now to the questions around whether or not our infrastructure and our communities are resilient to the changing climates. But in general, we are beginning to really feel the impact of climate change. At the community level, I can tell you my aunt who lives up country in the village right now, she doesn't have access to food because she can't dig. It's been totally dry. And so everything has to be purchased. And these are subsistence farmers who depend on the rains. And so we're really beginning to feel the pinch, that the effect of these changing climates.
God, that's a wonderful kind of, yeah, amazing kind of personal story that, you know, and it is those kind of subsistence farmers, you know, people are really living day-to-day basis that are really hardest hit by climate change. And then there's obviously, as a professional, you know, engineer, what are kind of you seeing as the kind of key design challenges in delivering resilient infrastructure that, you know, is going to help mitigate the impacts of climate change?
There are really a number of challenges we are facing, but from the design perspective, one of our major challenges we've observed, especially even during our assurance exercises, was that there's a limited presence of accurate weather records. Our third national development plan 2020 to 2025 indicated that in the baseline year, that was 2017-18, we had weather records that were only 30% accurate. And so, of course, the country is trying to put in place strategies to improve this to 90%. But, you know, our infrastructure, we design for, say, 100-year floods or certain extreme weather conditions. And if we don't have accurate records, it becomes a bit difficult to really predict and come up with appropriate designs. And then on the other end of things, we have limited regional climate models specific for East Africa. So yes, we do have a few climate models for East Africa. However, the idea around climate projections is such that these different climate models will interpret the interactions of greenhouse gas emissions rather differently. So each climate model generally has a different different set of results. And for climate researchers over time have been advising us to use an ensemble of climate models to provide generally these multimodal means that will basically be used to project. But for Uganda, we have limited presence of regional models to give us these accurate climate projections. And this, of course, now affects the planning, okay? Because the results of these models most times are giving us probability-based results. So they're saying there's a probability that this may occur. But people in the planning sectors of, especially, so let me give an example of transport infrastructure, we need to actually know, we need to reduce the uncertainties in terms of the timing, location, the magnitudes of these changes. And yet the presence, the models we do have are not really giving us this kind of data that is user-friendly for our planning purposes. And then this even aggravates the situation further because basically adapting to climate change, adapting our infrastructure to climate change many times is really costly. And so if we have a lot of uncertainties thrown in there, it becomes a rather difficult and cumbersome process of really planning when you have multitudes of solutions because of probabilities. So in general, we're just faced with this, I could call it a big box of challenges. But over time, of course, we're trying to see what strategies we can put in place to come up with a more accurate or predictions that can help us come up with more resilient, climate resilient infrastructure.
Thank you for that. It's very interesting. Diana, again, I mean, what role did COS Honduras play in ensuring that the reconstruction efforts have been open, transparent, and accountable?
What these tragedies have shown us is that Honduras is not prepared for this type of emergency. And that is where it's important to strengthen the participation of initiatives like ours. And that is why, as with COS Honduras, we have promoted the use of our CISOX platform, that is our disclosure platform, so that institutions in charge of these projects can disclose information related to the emergency ETA and IOTA, especially the project. Thus, we also measured the levels of transparency and infrastructure by applying Transparency Infrastructure Index using the methodology that was given by COS in this type of project, especially in this type of project. So the results we gained were low levels of disclosed information at 49.2% of 100. Also, we are aware of the need to measure the impacts of caused by the emergency, the quality of the infrastructure, and the management of resources that were allocated to it, especially executed through the emergency process, which history has made it very clear to us that it can be a place for different irregularities. So our AIDS assurance study was destined to review those eight projects, which shows the ones that were with the largest assigned budget, which included visits to the sites, and we are accompanied by the institution in charge. So we have worked together with the government that was the last government. Now with the new government, we're in the process of establishing a joint agenda that can allow us to accompany with a more participant role in this process of recovering, taking into consideration the work that we had done with the ET and also what we had done with the AIDS assurance process. We're very happy because one of the points that they're taking into consideration as important is transparency and accountability, especially in the reconstruction of our country. So it's a place that we can work together.
Absolutely. It's very interesting. I think I was looking at your assurance report earlier today, and it was which covers kind of eight projects, doesn't it? And it's an interesting range of, you've got a school that was washed away, there were roads as well, a lot of damage to those. This cleanup operation, which was a very interesting kind of a contract just to manage cleanup operation. A canal, there was an airport where there was some damage. I think it was the two road projects were very interesting in the fact that deforestation seems to have played a kind of a critical role in exacerbating the impact of the two hurricanes. And I'm just interested in terms of kind of the findings that, you know, that particular side of the findings of the report and what you're and how you've kind of, what recommendations you're stressing to the new government.
Yes, well, the eight assurance project that we take into consideration, as you said, were a range of cleaning, repairing of roads, reconstruction and containment of boards, also reconstruction of schools and everything related to our airport that was flooded completely. There were eight projects in total that had the most budget assigned for them. They were in charge of five public institutions, and of the primary findings that we find was that every project that was implemented was to solve an urgent problem, which did not allow them to carry out a proper planning. However, it was the only way to meet the objective with the agility in a timely manner, taking into consideration that they had to have a response immediately. It is also noted that all the works were fully justified since they respond to an emergency. And it also helped to contribute to the improvement of the country's infrastructure and development. The procurement process were all carried out through direct contract. And that is the thing that it kind of can take on irregularities. But one of the results that we found was that the five of the eight projects has modification to it in the contractual amounts of work execution, according to the contract. This increase amounts total in 8.63 million lems, for a total of 123.6 million lem. Original amount was 115 million. Likewise, it was evidence that the Global Information Disclosure Index of the project has an average of 75.3, as one INSEP, that is the infrastructure secret ministry, works together with COS. And it was the one that gained a biggest in disclosure index. But in comparison to our last reports, this is a low percentage. Also, in our findings was that the amount of contract of the supervising companies also underwent modifications. According to the contract, the original cost of supervising this project were 9.6 million lems. But with the modification, that amount increased by 1.4 million making a total of 11 million lamps that were given to the supervision. The cost under study also showed that 5 of the 8 executed projects report extension in the contractual deadline for the execution of the work. In this case, the authorization of section on Trojes, that is one of the places that was very affected, it was executed, which was to be executed in 90 days, reported the greatest extension of time since it was executed in 195 days. That is 105 more days than it was planned. This has an impact in the terms of execution of the project supervision contract. In particular case, the supervision period went from 92 to 115 days. The information all collected also revealed that the generation of employment in this reconstruction work has an important gender focus, and since one of every 10 people hired in this work were women. This also leads to reiterate the need to introduce transparency measures, especially in this type of emergency, to guarantee the proper use of public resources and the population affected by emergency receives timely attention from the state. And during this process, we have a lot of media coverage. The headlines were very attractive, especially when they said that they have the modification of the contract of the prices and a lot of justification by the government institution regarding the findings. As I said before, with the new government, we're in the process of establishing a joint agenda that allows us to review each of the findings with them and the recommendations that were also given. What type of recommendation, the use of institutions that already have experiences in this type of process. Because we have one institution that its purpose was created was another one. And during the emergency, they gave them the purpose of cleaning the roads, of cleaning the canals. So here is to have consideration institutions that already have that competency and also the experience regarding this type of emergency.
Very interesting. I mean, to check, you know, give them a different, I mean, it kind of reflects in some ways what we've learned from the COVID pandemic, that emergency procurement can lead to irregularities, the lack of transparency as well. And I think this has been a global problem. And we've seen it with some of the health facilities that have been procured for in response to the pandemic. So, I mean, it's very, very interesting. And Pamela, you mentioned about your aunt living in an area with a drought at the moment, I was very struck by an interview you said last year around climate and drought and things like that for COST, and last year you also published your own assurance report for COST Uganda covering 13 projects, including some very interesting irrigation projects, water projects in Western Uganda. And I mentioned earlier, one of the things in that report was really interesting was that citizens were telling the Ministry of Water and Environment that they just thought that these projects were government projects and they weren't necessarily for them. They weren't for their benefit, which is, it really demonstrates how important citizen engagement is. So it'd be great if you could tell us more about these kind of projects in Western Uganda and the water projects and what you identified.
Okay. That was our third assurance exercise that looked amongst this. You mentioned other projects. We two particularly water projects. That was the construction of the Nyamihanga solar-powered small-scale irrigation scheme. That was in Western Uganda. And then also the reconstruction of the Tamit Mabira Dam embankment, also in Western Uganda. And both of these facilities were under the Ministry of Water and Environment. The scope of the Mabira Dam project looked at the construction of an embankment, spillway, abstraction system, distribution network, and then storage reservoir. And the overall aim, of course, was to provide round-the-year supply of water for production, specifically for farming. Owing to the fact that Uganda is really experiencing these impacts of climate change, I can't even say them any further. We can no longer rely on the rains for agriculture because it's becoming really unreliable. And so these are some of the interventions that the government is now putting in place to curb such impacts. So from our assurance exercise, when we noted that this project was funded purely by the government of Uganda, it was a project worth 10 just over 10 billion Uganda shillings. That's about $2.9 million. It was funded purely by the government of Uganda. The project did experience some cost overruns, but that's because there were some changes in the scope, and as a result also experienced 33% time overruns. But in general, we noted that the project had a number of stakeholder engagement activities. And as such, a lot of the community concerns were basically identified throughout the life cycle of the project. And the communities were also informed of some of the project deliverables. And we believe that some of this also might have supported the success of this particular project. We also noted that there was women, youth, and other community dwellers were involved in the construction process in different capacities. But throughout the project, they were readily involved. Information on the project was available. However, it was not readily available on the platform or on the public platform for the Ministry of Water and Environment. It wasn't readily available on their website. We had about 8 to 10%. But when we went into requesting for additional information, we found that the information is available, but it was just not being published because they did not follow the cost idea standard on our 41 data points for proactive disclosure. But in general, the community did appreciate this project and thought that it was a good intervention to solve some of their issues. And arising from this, COST did provide some recommendations to the Ministry of Works and Ministry of Water and Environment and continued with the community engagement activities.
Thank you. And what was I think really interesting is that you have these amazing community meetings known as barazas, and I've been to one, but I've also seen photos of kind of women, children, men from the villages going to these meetings. And kind of what other issues did you find being raised by the citizens of these meetings?
For this particular project, the project team from the Ministry of Water and Environment had actually done a lot of community engagements. And so it was like, It was a good start because the community had raised a couple of issues throughout the project. And so during our barazas, actually, the community did note that they were really grateful for the government's initiative to increase their water for production. So for this particular project, it was more of cementing some of their praises and also just pointing out this concern may not have been addressed, and then it is addressed. However, we've had other projects which we've assured, and during our community barazas, the community does indicate that they've not been engaged. One case was a roads project and a Ministry of Works and Transport. And during that exercise, one, we noted that there was no environmental social impact study done. And then also the community had not been engaged. And they expressed dissatisfaction. Actually, during our community baraza, one of the LCs or local leaders did say, "You can't come to us at the end of the life of the project and expect us to adopt and just take it on." And so the good thing is the ministry was in attendance. So a lot of issues were raised. One was to do with road safety. The community did mention that they had experienced 3 accidents on one day on that road. And then also some of the community access roads connecting to the main road were really in poor shape, yet they were developed, improving just one road. There were delays in execution. The community did note that because this particular road was in poor state and there was a lot of delays, it had created an insecurity in the area. And a lot of these issues were raised with the ministry, the procuring entity. They did take note of that, and we actually did have a further engagement with them after that.
No, I understand, and I think they brought in some kind of speed bumps and things like that, didn't they? They cut into the that part of that district. Thank you, Pamela. Diana, you have a new innovative open data platform known as Infras. There's hopefully, I mentioned right at the start this issue of around a lack of data, and Pamela mentioned it as well about the lack of data around climate impacts, but also kind of weather, and it's interesting you're looking at kind of communities who may be impacted by environmental issues. So could you tell us about Infras and how it's helping to tackle this lack of data?
Yes, Infras is a tool that is designed by COS Honduras that presents a series of visualizations built from open data. The purpose of Infra is to promote an evidence-based decision-making process by relevant authorities and thus contribute to the design and implementation of a more sustainable and resilient infrastructure projects. Infra provides detailed information on the environmental risk of the projects carried out in the country. It also includes open data based from different institutions, which includes clarity and understanding of the scope of regulation and environmental risk, enhance decision-making and processes to reduce negative impacts by environment, and identify opportunities to develop more sustainable infrastructure projects. It also presents visualizations about public contracting carried out by the entities for the construction and supervision of infrastructure works at the national and local levels, as well as about infrastructure projects that entail resettlement plans, and also presents visualization about the initial and final amounts of the contracts of work, the total investment of each type of contract, and by the source of financing, as well as the total investment made in the infrastructure sector in each department. Infra offers a benefit to government officials, to the private sector, and also representative of our civil society, since it will be able to prevent approval of infrastructure works in an appropriate place, including vulnerable environmental zones, in addition to alerting those cause of serious environmental impacts during construction, such as degradation and deforestation, among others. So we're very proud of Infra. The fact that it is, we have information of different institutions, and we're in the process of connecting with the one in charge of our Ministry of Climate and Natural Resources, so we can see those projects that have a climate licenses approved, and also the measures that they're taking into consideration to reduce the impacts that are caused by the construction of the project. So I invite you to visit our Infras to see how it also works.
No, it is. It's a potentially, as a starting point, it's going to be it's very powerful, and I think it really demonstrates the potential. If we can connect different types of data, you can really help to better understand what the potential communities are really going to be impacted by climate change, and then develop and adapt that infrastructure to meet their needs, and particularly those communities are very vulnerable to climate change. So I think it's a very interesting case. And just to very, very quickly, both Pamela and Diana, it'd be great if you could just give me, based on your experience you've had, just kind of what's the next big step for you believe, maybe starting with Pamela, what do you believe is the next kind of step that you believe we need to ensure that infrastructure that's resilient is delivered in a more transparent and accountable way?
Thank you, John. I'll start off by just saying climate investment, as I mentioned earlier, it's in many cases really high. And so there's always a concern of whether we should use that much money to adapt or our infrastructure to climate change. Yet we're not even sure that climate event will actually occur when we predict it to occur. So as engineers, we're looking at a most structurally sound solution that is also least cost possible. But we need to appreciate that our infrastructure does have an impact on the changing climate. Our construction process is heavily mechanized. These equipment emit greenhouse gases into the environment. And so in as much as we need to improve our infrastructure to be more resilient, we have a role we are playing in actually creating this changing climate. And so our investments should also look at our finances, our climate finance, and these investments should look at solutions to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. I believe if we incorporate this into our procurement process, if we could include some kind of carbon budget throughout the whole life cycle of the asset, rather than the traditional procurement process that was looking at the lowest price possible, we need to start looking at best evaluated bidders that incorporate climate-related issues, such that the procurement process is not just driven by money, but it's also driven by these changes. That way we'll be more accountable to the world, to our efforts in basically coming up with reductions of the changing climates. And then finally,
you got one other thing, very quickly.
I believe we need to have a concerted effort in coming up with all these solutions. We need to collaborate between the academia, industry, policies, politically. We can't continue working in silos. Our solutions will be single faceted. We need to have a multifaceted solutions that look at all different angles, such that at the end of the day, we are putting in the different capacities to come up with really a holistic solution.
No, thank you, Pamela. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, we don't talk about the process of construction, and it is very hard, heavy in terms of carbon. So that's a very, very interesting point you're making there. And Diana, do you have a kind of final thought on where we take this?
Yes. Well, in accordance to our experience, being that we are a country that is very vulnerable to the climate change, I consider that the first step is that the infrastructure must be conceived, designed, and executed considering the environmental risks to which we are exposed. We can no longer think just to make a road, for example. We have to take into consideration those risks that as a country we're exposed, right? So in turn, this information should be available for the public. In the sense that they should be able to participate during the whole cycle of the infrastructure as a consultation, and they have to have access of information. We have seen with the implementation of our CSOX, the second 2.0 version, that people use the system and that they have discovered irregularities regarding the execution of projects. So in our case, with the new system, with our new version of the CSOX 3.0, environmental indicators are included, such as the environmental impact if it falls into any category established by the law. That also measures what type of measures they're being taken into consideration to reduce the environmental impact. So it's very important that data related to climate investment be available to the public, in which the government can provide it firsthand and can be accountable of it. So a portal is very important. We have advanced with our infra and our CSOX, but I think the information is power. So information should be available for the citizens regarding this type of investment.
Great. Thank you, Diana. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Getting that data from the environmental as well as the infrastructure really is so important. I think one starting point, I just looking at the UN report earlier, was what we might do with the APN cost is look, we have the open contracting for infrastructure data standards. And as you know, we require the disclosure of the source of funding. So we could have a category related to climate finance to say, this funding relates to private sector climate finance funding or multilateral. So that, you know, it should be something relatively easy to put in, and then that becomes available. So Pamela and Diana, thank you very much for your time and these fascinating insights that you've been able to offer, and you know, your experience and your personal stories, particularly Pamela about your aunt, and Diana about what happened during the, you know, ETA and IOTA in Honduras. I mean, I think we've probably only just scratched the surface in how we can finance, deliver low carbon and resilient infrastructure and making it more transparent and accountable. But thank you very much for the conversation. It was very enjoyable. So thank you very much to everyone who's listened. If you would like to know more about the cost assurance report process and these reports, they're available on infrastructuretransparency.org, and you'll be able to read them there. And I think there's links to the Honduras and Uganda sites where you'll be able to find these reports. But otherwise, I'd like to thank you very much for your time, and goodbye.